estimation in which all of our yearning for happiness, for peace, for freedom, find their complete fulfillment. It's the goal that they point to as their own inherent tendency. Then further, the Buddha also makes use of poetic or metaphorical terms for nibbana. For example, he calls nibbana the island, the deep. This is a very beautiful word. In one text, in the Sutta Nibbata, he speaks of all living beings as being swept away by a tumultuous river, a fearsome flood which is sweeping them helplessly into the ocean of birth, old age, and death. And all of these beings seek a place of safety and security, an island which they can land upon and be free from the suffering of birth and death. And so the Buddha calls Nibbana the island, the deepa, which provides safety and security from the dangers of samsara, from the ocean of becoming. The Buddha also calls Nibbana the cave. The cave is a place which gives safety from the threat of storms, wild beasts, robbers, and so on. And so Nibbana gives us safety from all the dangers of birth and death. Nibbana is called the cool state, the state that results, the coolness that results from the extinguishing of the fires of greed, hatred, and delusion. He calls Nibbana the shelter, the refuge, the further shore. The Buddha says that in our worldly life, we are like a man in a hostile land, faced with all sorts of dangers. Wild beasts are running after him. He's being pursued by enemies with drawn swords. He's chased by thieves who are out to rob him. He runs and runs until he comes to the edge of a stream. He wants to get across to the other side where he can find safety. But he has no boat, so he builds a raft. He paddles his way across. And he reaches the safety of the other shore. Here in this parable, the near shore, the region where the man is stuck, that is the symbol for birth and death, filled with all the dangers, troubles, and suffering. The stream is the current of craving, the current of defilement that we have to cross. And the further shore, the destination, the place of safety, that is Nibbana. Now, the attainment of Nibbana comes in two stages. These two stages are spoken of as the two Nibbana elements, or two elements of Nibbana, Nibbana Dhatu. One is the Nibbana element with a residue remaining. The other is the Nibbana element without a residue remaining. The Nibbana element with a residue remaining, in Pali, this is the sa-upadhi-sesa Nibbana Dhatu. And this is the state of Nibbana which is attained in this present life by the arahat, the liberated one. The arahat has followed the path to its end. He's eradicated all the mental defilements, and he's attained Nibbana in this present life. The element of Nibbana which he realizes is called the Nibbana element with a residue remaining. Now, what is the residue that is remaining? The residue is the set of five aggregates that constitute his present life individuality. At the moment of birth, he acquired the compound of five aggregates that make up his psychophysical organism. These he grasped through his ignorance and craving from the past life. But in this present life, this person has reached liberation. He learned the Dhamma from the Buddha. He practiced the path, brought it to fulfillment. And by bringing it to fulfillment, he extinguished all of his defilements. But with the extinguishing of the defilement, his individual being composed of five aggregates doesn't come to an end immediately. His body and mind continue on to the end of the lifespan. The psychophysical organism that remains, this combination of the five aggregates, this is the residue that stays on in his attainment of Nibbana. Even while living in the state of perfect liberation of mind, the arhat continues to perform the necessary functions of life. He doesn't simply enter into some unbroken trance and remain there until his death, but he goes about his daily activities. He goes to sleep at night, he wakes up in the morning, he eats, he goes to the bathroom, he talks, he performs his various duties, and so on. On the surface, he might seem very much like others. He doesn't wear a label that says, "I'm an arhat." But though he goes about his daily activities, he has completely uprooted and abolished all the defilements, greed, hatred, and delusion. He cannot perform any action of body, speech, or mind that springs from these defilements. And because the state of Nibbana is marked by the destruction of defilements, it is also called the Kilesa Parinibbana, the Nibbana that consists in the extinguishing of the defilements. And in this state of Nibbana, the five aggregates still stand. That is the residue that's remaining. But though they still stand, they no longer harbor the force that built them, the force that brought them into being. That is the force of craving. The Buddha says that in the case of the arhat, these five aggregates stand cut off at the root, uchina mula. The five aggregates of the ordinary being, these five aggregates contain craving. They contain the root or source of more becoming in the future, the root of existence, craving. But the aggregates of the arhat, those are cut off at the root. They are five purified aggregates. They're no longer clung to, no longer grasped and held to, no longer identified as being I, me, myself. And when they stand and function, they function just like a phonograph that has been turned off. When we turn off a phonograph, the turntable continues to revolve until it loses its momentum and comes to a stop. But even though it turns, there's no more electricity coming through to keep it revolving. Similarly, in the case of the arhat, there's no more craving and no more clinging running through his mind, sustaining the process of becoming and leading it on to future existences. His five aggregates continue on to the end of his life, but the five aggregates stand cut off at the root. They no longer support the craving out of which they have arisen. To understand the experience of the arhat, the experiential side of the Nibbana element with the residue remaining, we can look at it from three points of view, according to the three basic aspects of human experience. The affective side, the side of feeling and emotion, the volitional side, the aspect of will, and the cognitive side, the aspect of knowledge and understanding. First, we'll look at it from the affective side. And from this angle, the experience of Nibbana is a state of complete happiness, the state which is utterly free from all mental suffering, from sorrow, grief, worry, and fear. It doesn't mean that the arhant doesn't experience pain anymore. The arhant can still feel pain with the body. If he makes contact with sharp or rough objects, he'll feel physical pain. But this pain doesn't disturb his mind in any way. It doesn't cause him annoyance, sorrow, anger, or fear. The arhat's experience of Nibbana is not only a state of perfect happiness, but it's also a state of unshakable peace. This peace comes about through the stilling of all the defilements. The Buddha says that the defilements are fevers, vexations, disturbances. They cause trouble and anxiety in the mind. The unenlightened mind, the mind which still harbors the defilement, is always underlaid by a deep-rooted agitation, by a fundamental restlessness, by a basic lack of peace. Sometimes the mind is agitated about the past, worrying about things that have been done in the past. Sometimes it's worrying about things in the future, things that lie ahead. Sometimes it's worrying what's going on elsewhere in the present. But so often the mind is agitated, anxious, worried. But with the abandoning of all forms of attachment, with the relinquishing of all craving and clinging, then there comes complete freedom from agitation, restlessness, and worry. That is Nibbana, the state of unruffled peace. Nibbana is also a state of complete fearlessness. All fear comes from the notion of a self, an ego. When we become afraid, what we're really afraid of is that something is going to happen to me, to myself, or to those things that I believe belong to me. And as long as there is this notion of an I, a self lurking in the background of the mind, then we remain vulnerable to fear and to worry. But when the notion of an ego has been uprooted and completely destroyed, that the sense of I-ness no longer hangs over our experience, then there comes liberation from all fear. The Buddha says that there are two beings who cannot be frightened by the crashing of a thunderbolt. One is the elephant, the other is the arhat. The elephant isn't frightened because of his powerful body, also because of his small intelligence. But the arhat is not frightened because he is completely free from all self-attachment. Therefore, the Buddha calls Nibbana the state of complete security, Kamabhumi, or the supreme security from turmoil. And he also calls it the fearlessness, the state of fearlessness. Again, from the emotional angle, Nibbana can be viewed as a state of perfect equanimity. The arhat looks upon all things with complete equality, with perfect balance of mind. He's no longer swayed by personal preferences. He no longer indulges in false distinctions and discriminations. The untrained mind is generally shaken by the changes of the world, what's called the eight worldly winds, which come in four pairs. These are gain and loss, fame and dishonor, praise and blame, pleasure and pain. Generally, we're attached to gain, fame, praise, and pleasure, and we're distressed by loss, dishonor, blame, and pain. But the mind of the arhant is unshaken by all of these winds of worldly changes. His mind is steady like a mountain of solid rock, steady and unmoving. In all circumstances, the mind of the arhant, the liberated one, is imperturbable. He doesn't go running after gain, honor, praise, and pleasure. He doesn't become upset if he meets loss, dishonor, blame, and pain. He looks upon all these different states so they were the same. None of them gets an inner grip or a hold upon his mind. However, it has to be emphasized that this equanimity of the arhat doesn't amount to indifference or apathy. It doesn't mean that the arhat is unconcerned with the welfare of others. Sometimes in the later Buddhist literature, especially of the Mahayana, the arhats have been depicted as cold and indifferent people, concerned only with their own salvation. This picture, however, doesn't agree with the impressions of the arhat that we get from the Pali canon. In the Pali text, the Buddha emphasizes again and again that the supreme person, the most praiseworthy person, is the one who is intent on both his own welfare and the welfare of others. The disciple, first of all, has to accomplish the goal for himself. Only when he's on dry land by himself can he lift others out of the mud. Only when he's liberated himself can he effectively teach and guide others to liberation. But those who reach the goal, who achieve deliverance, they become the teachers and guides for their fellow men. The Buddha says that the arahants are living in the world for the welfare of the many folk, for the happiness of the many folk, out of compassion for the world, for the good welfare and happiness of all living beings. He says that the arahants are instructors, exhorters, who exhort, inspire, and encourage others who are capable of expounding the true Dhamma. He says that it is beneficial even to see such persons, to approach them, to serve them, to call them to mind, to study under them, and to practice under them. He says that the arahants are the masters, the caravan leaders, the purifiers, the dispellers of darkness, the creators of light, the torchbearers, the sons of illumination for all the world. The arahant's mind is stirred by immeasurable loving kindness and boundless compassion. He pervades all the world with thoughts of loving kindness, thinking, may all beings be well and happy. And he radiates thoughts of compassion, wishing that all beings might be free from suffering, from all harm and trouble. Now this deals with the experience of Nibbana in terms of feeling and emotion. Now to deal with it in terms of will or volition. In our ordinary experience, the will is held in bondage by the defilement. We move and act in the grip of the defilement, and therefore we're driven to act in ways which we know to be harmful even to our own welfare, under the sway of greed, hatred, delusion, and fear. We act even contrary to our own best interests. Because of our greed and desire, we chase after transitory pleasures, even though we know that in the long run, these will have disastrous consequences. We give rise to anger and hatred, which destroy our inner calm, and which disrupt our personal relationships. We're held in the chains of greed, anger, conceit, worry, jealousy, and so on. But the arahant's mind is totally free, even from the smallest trace of these bonds. He enjoys complete inner autonomy. He lives as master of himself. He has sovereignty over all the workings of his mind. His mind can no longer be dominated, gripped, and compelled by unwholesome motives. And therefore, he never acts in any ways destructive to his own welfare or to the welfare of others, but always in ways which are beneficial, which serve the good of others as well as his own good. The Buddha compares the arahant to a lotus flower. The lotus flower is unstained by all the mud in the pond in which it grows. Even when the muddy water touches it, it immediately falls off the petals without sticking or adhering to the petals. So in the same way, the mind of the arahant, when it makes contact with sensory phenomena, when the arahant goes through different experiences, his mind is unstained by the defilements, like greed, hatred, and delusion, but all these worldly phenomena, just immediately they just slip through without giving rise to any defiled motivation. Now, the volitions of the unenlightened person bring about karma. For the unenlightened person, every willed action deposits a seed in the mind with a tendency to produce results, to bring about happiness or suffering in the future, to ripen in a form of future rebirth. The arahant, however, has broken free entirely from the cycle of actions and reactions. He still performs volitional actions, but these acts of his are the great exception to the rule that all volitional actions are karma. The arhant acts, as we've said, are not karma. They are mere activities, kriyamata, activities that take place without leaving any trace on the mind of the arhant. His acts are trackless, like the flight of birds across the sky. The arhat still reaps the results of his old karmas performed through his many past lives. He still meets with the pleasant and painful fruits of those actions. But these don't disturb him in any way. They don't upset or stir his mind. He doesn't react to them in terms of the instinctive patterns that have been built up through the defilement. But he observes them with perfect mindfulness and clear comprehension. Thus, he's cut off all the chains of suffering. Then, thirdly, the experience of Nibbana can be considered in terms of knowledge or understanding. We find that the arhant enjoys perfect understanding, complete realization. His mind is the awakened mind, the enlightened mind, the mind that has been illuminated by the knowledge of things as they truly are. He is no longer misled by the distortions, the projections, the perversions, but he understands and sees all conditioned phenomena as impermanent, unsatisfactory, without any ego reference. His state of mind is one of full wisdom, full comprehension. It's the meaning of sambodhi, enlightenment. Okay, so this deals with the arhat's experience of the Nibbana element with the residue remaining. His living experience, which is a state of perfect happiness, complete peace, complete inner freedom, and full awakening and understanding. Now, the second stage in the attainment of Nibbana is called the Nibbana element without a residue remaining. Anupadisesa Nibbana Dhatu. This is the element of Nibbana that is attained by the arhant with his passing away, with the breakup of the body, what we conventionally call death. But in the case of the arhant, the Buddha does not use the word death. This word applies to ordinary beings, not to the arhant. The notion death is connected with birth. It's an event, a phase that takes place in the round of becoming, the round of birth and death. And the notion of death has its basis in the conception of a self who dies. It's valid only insofar as there is still the notion of a self in the mind. But the passing away of the arhant is a final and complete passing away from conditioned existence. It doesn't lead to a new birth. And subjectively, it isn't conceived as the death of myself. In his own experience of death, the arhat sees only the cessation of a process, not the death of a self. The experience for him is without any subjective reference, any reference to me or mine. The Nibbana attained by the arhat with his passing away is the Nibbana element without residue remaining. And it receives this designation because when it's attained, the residue of the five aggregates comes to an end. Now, for an unenlightened being, when death takes place, his craving and karma reconstitute the process of the five aggregates with a new physical basis. As a result, rebirth occurs and the flux of becoming goes on. New death followed by more, new birth followed by more aging and death. But with the passing away of the arhant, there is no more rebirth. His mind has been freed from craving and clinging, and all his old karma built up from the beginningless past becomes defunct, becomes ineffective. Since the arhant doesn't come to any more physical existence, he provides his karma with no more basis by which it can ripen. And thus, with the passing away of the Arhant, the process of the five aggregates, the beginningless process of becoming, comes to an end, it draws to a close. And therefore, this attainment of the Nibbana element without residue is also called the Khandaparinibbana, Nibbana consisting in the extinguishing of the process of the five aggregates. Now, the question often comes up, what is the state of the Arhat after death? Is it a state of annihilation or non-existence, or a state of eternal existence in some form? The Buddha rejects both of these alternatives. He says that any answer, any attempt to answer this question is inapplicable, invalid. The question, what is the state of the Arhat after death, arises because of an intellectual clinging, a subtle clinging to the idea that the Arhat has a self which must become either eternalized or annihilated. But since the Arhant or any other being for that matter cannot be conceived as a self, the state of the Arhat and final Nibbana cannot be conceived as either eternal existence or as annihilation. The Arhat doesn't enter into some state of eternal existence, either as an individual self in some heavenly world, or as a universal self in some impersonalized form. But also, final Nibbana is not a state of annihilation, where there is no self to be annihilated and extinguished. What we call the Arhat is a dependently arisen process of becoming, and the attainment of final Nibbana is a cessation to that beginningless process of becoming. To try to speak of what lies beyond the ending of this process, this is to venture outside the boundaries of conceptualization, outside the boundaries of language. There's a sutta, the 15th sutta of the Digha Nikaya, in which the Buddha says, in so far only is there any pathway for words, any pathway for language, any pathway for concepts, any sphere of understanding. That is, when there is consciousness together with mind and body process, nama rupa and vijnana. When there's no remainder of consciousness with the mind-body process, then there's no pathway for words, no pathway for language, no pathway for concepts. So from this we can see that when the five aggregates, the mind-body processes, then there's no room for language, concepts, or knowledge, nothing to point to and to designate. Here, words become totally inadequate and unsatisfactory. The concepts can't penetrate the inconceivable, and the mind can't measure the immeasurable. There are a few interesting sutta passages that in which the question of the state of the Arhat after death is raised. In one sutta, the 72nd sutta of the Majjhima Nikaya, the wandering ascetic, a non-Buddhist named Vajragota, comes to the Buddha and he asks, he says, Venerable Sir, does the enlightened one, the liberated one, the Arhant, does he exist after death? The Buddha says, to say he exists after death, that doesn't apply. Then the wanderer asks, then does he not exist after death? Buddha says, non-existence doesn't apply. The wanderer tries the combination. Does he both exist and not exist after death? The Buddha says, that doesn't apply. Then he tries the double negation. Does he neither exist nor non-exist after death? The Buddha says, say he neither exists nor non-exists after death, that doesn't apply. And so the Buddha rejects all these four alternatives. wanderer says, I'm puzzled, I don't understand. Then the Buddha uses an analogy. He says, suppose there's a fire. The fire burns and blazes in dependence upon its fuel, upon the sticks and logs. Now if the fire doesn't get any further fuel when it uses up the old fuel, then it goes out. Suppose we ask, when the fire goes out, where does it go? Does it go to the north, to the south, to the east, to the west? The wanderer says, none of these apply. All of these are inapplicable. The fire has simply gone out. The Buddha says, it's the same way with the arahant. The dependently arisen process of becoming has come to an end. However, in case the idea that final nibbana is a state of non-existence comes to the mind, the Buddha dispels us with what he says further. He says that the liberated one, the Tathagata, freed from reckoning by way of the five aggregates, by way of form, feelings, the perceptions, the mental formations, and consciousness, the Tathagata is deep, immeasurable, and unfathomable, like the great ocean, not to be conceived by the finite concepts of the mind, not to be measured by the measuring devices of the mind. There's another similar sutta which is spoken by a nun, a bhikkhuni, named Kama. Kama comes to see King Basenadi Kosala, king of the state of Kosala. And King Basenadi asks the same questions about the state of the Tathagata after death. And to each of these, the nun Kama says, that is not declared by the Buddha. The Buddha doesn't say that the arhat exists eternally after death, that he becomes non-existent, that both he both exists and doesn't exist, that he neither doesn't exist nor non-exists after death. The king is puzzled and asks for an explanation. The bhikkhuni Kama says, do you have, O Majesty, do you have a minister, a treasurer, or an accountant who is able to measure the waters in the ocean, say that there's so much water in the ocean? The king says, no, I don't. And so in the same way, bhikkhuni says, the Tathagata, the enlightened one, free from reckoning by way of the five aggregates, is like the great ocean, deep, immeasurable, and unfathomable. Then there's one very beautiful sutta in the collection, the Sutta Nipata, called the Parayana. And in this, an inquiring Brahmin comes to the Buddha and asks him about the state of the liberated one and final Nibbana. The Buddha replies in verse. He says, just as a flame flung into the wind flies to its end and no more comes into the range of conceiving, so the sage, released from name and form, from mind and body, reaches the end, the final goal, and no more comes into the range of concept. Then the inquirer asks, does he who has reached the goal become non-existent, or does he exist eternally in a state of everlasting bliss? Answer this question for me, O wise one, for you are the one who has understood the truth. Then the Buddha answers. He says, there is no way to measure the man who has reached the goal. That by which we can speak of him, that does not exist for him. When all dhammas, that is, when all the states of mind and body and the five aggregates, when all dhammas have been removed, then all the pathways of speech have been removed. And since all the pathways of speech have been removed, at this point the lecture will come to an end.